Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Homestead Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your absolute favorite Saturday morning show, heard exclusively here on WEEB. We are here to engage in taking aim. Let's see if I can talk. I'm Steve Woodward, along with David Hensley. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Steve.
Thank you for joining us, everybody. We have got a lot to talk about today, a lot to get to. We first of all want to acknowledge our sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, since 1980, a great destination for breakfast and lunch and all of your catering requirements. So thank you, Luke Black and the Marketplace, for being our loyal sponsor of this fine program. Also, I want to remind you that coming up later, we will have an exclusive interview with two individuals who are behind the evolution of the Veterans Treatment Court in Moore County, which is to debut next month in late September. We'll get to them later in the program. David, we have to identify, as we do each and every week, our public enemy number one, numero uno. And it's a phenomenon. It's not always a person. Sometimes it's a plague, a pox on our civilization. And in this case, it would be the identity politics culture that is fomented by the public education industrial complex. Explain to our viewers and listeners, David, how this has come about.
Yeah, you know, earlier this week, the Aberdeen Police Department posted on Facebook, recognizing Women's Equality Day, right? So they're celebrating Women's Equality Day. And so I shared it on a local Facebook group, a very vocal public forum, and I said, so when is the town of Aberdeen going to have Men's Equality Day? And oh boy, people just piled on. You know, all these people came in, mostly females, talking about how the patriarchy's kept them down. And I mean, hundreds and hundreds of posts. And I was reading this stuff, and they were all women. Most of them were women in their 30s, right, and up. But it was, and you know, after analyzing, I always look for root causes of stuff. For example, if you want to find the, you know, why is there violence at Cranes Creek, you really got to look at Southern Pines Elementary. But that's a whole nother show. But anyway, so I was looking for the root cause, and, you know, why do these people all feel like they're victims of the patriarch? I mean, literally, this is what they were saying, that they're repressed, they're victims of the patriarch, and they're victims, victims, victims. Like, where's all this victimhood coming from? And then it dawned on me, none other than our public schools. Our public schools are playing a role in the balkanization of the United States. And look, you really got to, this is a very, very subtle point, but people have to understand it. So kind of expand your mind a little bit and listen to what I'm about to say. And by the way, I brought this up 2 years ago under the Levy School Board, and Levy and the so-called conservatives didn't want to do any of this. But if you look at what we do in public schools, we should be celebrating math. We should have Math Month. We should have Reading Wednesdays. We should have Pi Day. We should have Physics Week. We should have, you know, Science Week. We should have we should have stuff that centers around our mission, which is education. Instead, we observe and celebrate Black History Week. or Black History Month. We observe and celebrate Hispanic History Day. We celebrate all these things, observe and celebrate not things that are related to our mission, but divisive identity politics.
And not to mention, although it's not during the academic year, Pride Month each and every June.
Right. God forbid if Pride Month was like in February, public schools across, well, in fact, there are schools that go into June and they celebrate Pride Month.
Exactly.
And all that is, it's divisive identity politics. So it's my assertion, if you wonder why we have this entire generation now going on our second generation of people who feel they're oppressed by the patriarch or whatever, they feel like they're victims because of whatever. By the way, none of these people could point to a single federal, state, or local law that discriminated against them. They couldn't name one, but by God, they were victims of the patriarch or they were victims of the system. If you wonder where that's coming from, it's coming from none other than our public schools who knowingly or not are teaching people identity politics, that everything should be looked at through the lens of someone's race or gender, and then it makes everyone think that they're victims. And we should eliminate that. We should only observe and celebrate things related to our mission. Let's take a college football team, right? When a person scores a touchdown, they celebrate that person's touchdown, right? They're not like, oh, well, you know, he's the first African-American or first Polish-American left-handed to, you know, score a touchdown, right? They celebrate. But in academia, they did away with celebrating. They specifically did away with nationwide, it was a nationwide movement to do away with the valedictorian, salutatorian. They did away with spelling bee. They did away with anything that recognized academic achievement and academic merit, and they replaced it with divisive identity politics that's the resulting of the balkanization of America.
And they also replaced it with this embrace of ignoring the creeping signs of mental illness in our youth, and instead sort of enabling that mental illness to fester and spread through expressions which we are now seeing frequently of transgenderism and just overall gender dysphoria.
Right.
And instead of saying, this is something we need to be very serious about and we need to address, but and seeing it as a flaw in the system, they see it as an outcome of their empathy toward these kids. And where does that lead? It leads to trans school shooters. And we had a wake-up call again yesterday, or earlier this week, I should say, in Minneapolis,
right,
where you have a trans school shooter who, and you know, it's a stretch to call this one a school shooting. It was on a campus of a Catholic school, but the target was the church on the campus during a Catholic mass. Okay, that was the target. So this deranged person was not merely going after random kids on a school ground. He was going after children and adults in the state of worship, in the state of a formal Catholic mass, which makes it all the more heinous. So the point here is, and this is not a leap that we're making here, but this litany of trans individuals who are showing up and engaging in random violent shooting incidents, and we're seeing one after another, this is not some momentary aberration. This, in fact, I fear, is a growing trend, and it goes right back to the negligence of our educators and our administrators in recognizing that they have a role to play, not in advancing this normalizing of gender dysphoria and gender transitioning, but they have a role and a responsibility to play in dealing with it with the parents, through the system, with the courts as necessary, and they won't do it. In fact, you have 2 years ago, the governor of Minnesota, who we've gotten to know, unfortunately, way too well, Tim Walz, because he ran for vice president last year, believe it or not. Tim Walz, as governor, refused to promote a piece of legislation that would have added funding for the security of non-public schools, such as Catholic schools, private schools. He did not push that initiative, but he did go out of his way to declare that the state of Minnesota had become a trans sanctuary in mid-2023. Fast forward to 2 years, to earlier this week in Minneapolis. That sanctuary has left two innocent children dead and 17 other individuals wounded, some of them seriously.
Well, if you look at, well, let's talk about Tim Walz for a minute. In addition to doing the things that you said, you remember during the campaign, Tim Walz oddly said, I've made friends with school shooters. So let's just put two and two together with Mr. Walz right here. I become friends with school shooters. That's an exact quote of what he said during the, he was the Democrat vice presidential candidate running with Kamala Harris. He said that he made Minnesota a sanctuary state for trans people. He turned down funding to provide security for private schools, and he said that he made friends with trans shooting. And I wonder if he was friends with this 23-year-old person who shot up this, who murdered these kids.
And then you have the feckless.
And people vote for these people.
Yeah. And the other one yesterday, there were several elected officials who came to the rushed to the microphones yesterday. One of them was the mayor of Minneapolis, this raging lunatic Marxist Democrat, who said, "I don't want to hear anybody asking for thoughts and prayers for these people. They were praying when they were shot." And what did he mean by that? As if to diminish the power of prayer, I suppose. He was saying, "See." They're praying to God didn't save them from the bullets of the shooter, did it?
So
in that moment, this is where the path this guy chooses to go down, to denounce the act of prayer in at a time when that is the instinct of any normal person after a terrible tragedy such as that one.
It's worse than that, Steve, and here's why. Those were Democrat talking points that were passed out because Jen Psaki and other Democrats made almost the exact same point simultaneously. So you know how the Democrats, they send out talking points and you see they'll do the collage of, talking heads and they all say the same thing, or they'll have like tweets from all the senators and they basically say the same thing. Those were Democrat talking points out. And I'll tell you how I know. One is what I just said, the fact that, dozens of them made the same point at essentially the same time because, they all plagiarize like they're a Harvard president or something, right? The other reason I know it is because I remember a couple school shootings ago. Unfortunately, you can't keep up because of the mental illness in our society. But anyway, I remember a school shooting or two. One person, a Democrat elected official, I think it might have been Uvalde, made that assertion. And I thought, wow, that is weird. And I filed it away. And then fast forward a school shooting or two, and it becomes the Democrat talking points.
Right.
That's exactly what happened. But let's look at one other point about this, how the schools participate in perpetuating this, is if you remember back, 4 years ago in the Moore County schools, there were people in the central office who are now gone, and there were people on the school board and people running for school board, looking at you, Rolly Sampson, who thought mistakenly that it was the job of a counselor and the job of a school district to keep secrets from parents. And Moore County Schools was doing that. They were not doing it. We nipped it in the bud. It was happening to some degree. But, my God, look at Loudoun County. God, I used to live in the county.
Fairfax County?
Is it Fairfax?
One of those Northern Virginia counties.
Yeah, one of those Northern Virginia counties who was they were facilitating abortions for high school girls, like 15, 16-year-olds, and not telling the parents.
Yeah.
So public schools are playing, just like public schools are, by embracing identity politics and perpetuating that, not only are they participating creating the balkanization of America, but they're also facilitating these mentally ill children rather than get them treated. They're hiding, they're actively hiding it from their parents.
And when an organization comes to the fore, such as Moms for Liberty, which took it upon itself to go into these school districts and expose the fact that there was a policy in many cases requiring teachers and educators to deliberately aid and abet children who were seeking gender transition. And part of that mission was to make sure that mom and dad didn't know about it. And when Moms for Liberty began to expose these incidents around the country, they were branded by the Biden administration as domestic terrorists.
Right.
Believe it or not.
Oh, 100%.
So you cannot understate how far gone these people are, and there are consequences for these I hate to call them beliefs, but whatever it is that drives them to perpetuate all of this social deviance to the point where it becomes the norm. This is the core issue.
So let's look at something else that's causing this is because of, well, you know, Hollywood made a movie, you know, so of course the liberals had to pass a law. The liberals in the 80s made it almost impossible, if not impossible, to involuntarily commit someone to a mental institution. Someone can be absolutely nuts and surrounded by loved ones who want them to get, and regardless whether the person's 16 years old or 26 years old or 36 years, this happens time and time again. And my guess is almost everybody, I've personally witnessed a situation like this, actually more than one, where there's a person who's mentally ill, and there are loved ones around that person who wants that person to get treatment. And it is in America today, because of laws passed by liberals in the 80s, it is almost impossible, if not impossible, to involuntarily commit someone to a mental institution. So once again, liberal policies, this is the result 40 years later. Let's look at this specific trans shooter in Minneapolis. You know, God, how horrible. But, you know, if you look at, you know, look at his parents. I'm not seeing the father, but, you know, the mother, there's been a lot said and, you know, posted about the mother. The mother looks very normal, right? She was a member of the church. She somehow worked at that school where that shooting happened. And, you know, you have to assume that she was a loving, you know, normal, well-adjusted mother. And my guess is, and this is speculation, but if you sat down with her, you know, and said, hey, you know, what happened? My guess is she would probably say, you know what, we tried and tried to get help for my son. You know, I loved him. We tried to get help for him, but there was no way to involuntarily commit him. There's a 99% chance that they tried to get help for their son, but because of the laws that the liberals passed, it was impossible to involuntarily commit him to it. They had to have known he was nuts.
I mean, sure. I mean, the depth of
the videos and stuff,
the
of that
videos
guy.
and the depth of his
postings.
Illness and his contempt towards society and his hatred of the president of the United States and on and on and on.
Israel, you know, look, if you listen to the media, first of all, the guy's manifesto, he was very intelligent. I mean, he wrote, I mean, his handwriting, his printing was impeccable, and he expressed himself extraordinarily well in writing. I mean, I'm actually envious of how well he expressed himself. But if you read, his complaints were Donald Trump, Israel, Jews, you know, Jewish people. If you watch CNN and MSNBC and all that garbage media, and you read his manifesto, it was obvious that he was influenced by their propaganda.
And how many more are just like him right now out there under the radar? And by the way, the left, such as Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, raced to the microphones yesterday to say, see, yet another incident that reminds us of the necessity of stricter gun control, stricter laws that the Republicans push back against every single time. And then you find out that all of the firearms that this young man used during the incident were illegally purchased. Now, what does that tell you? It's got to tell you that the background check system in Minnesota is broken, because minimal background checks on this individual probably would have led to the sale of these firearms never happening, would be my guess. But Amy Klobuchar, a sitting senator, wants to immediately start talking about things she doesn't even understand. She was saying, well, clearly he was using an automatic rifle, given the number of rounds he was able to fire in a short amount of time. Well, what does she know about an automatic rifle? Nothing. I guarantee you that. And it doesn't really matter how you designate the firearm. The fact of the matter is that once it's in the hands of a mentally ill person, you know, it's not about defending the Second Amendment. It's about recognizing that you have a serious mental health problem. And to your point, not deflecting parents who want to get help for their kids, but giving them options to do that very thing.
So the whole, you know, liberals just want to ban guns, and liberals want to blame inanimate objects for generally what's a result of their policies, right? So let's take a look at, oh, it's got to be guns, it's got to be guns. When I was growing up, and this is no lie, in the school parking lot of public schools in Oklahoma, there would be pickups, and in the back of the pickups would be inevitably rifle racks. And most pickups had rifles or shotguns in their rifle racks in the school parking lot during school. So don't, you know, literally in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, until Clinton made them gun-free zones. Clinton made schools gun-free zones when he was president. You know, in between, you know, sessions with Monica Lewinsky and getting stuff thrown at him by Hillary, he managed to pass the Gun-Free Zone Act. And but up until that time, there were no school shootings, no school, zero, zip, zip. It started in Stockton, California, by a crazed man. And before that, there were no school shootings, and students had rifles and shotguns and presumably pistols in their vehicles. So it's not the guns. Another little statistic is the country with the highest ownership of firearms per capita is Switzerland. In fact, by law, every male is a reservist in the military, and they have automatic weapons in their homes. And it is the safest country in the world. So don't tell me that guns cause crimes. But then you look at where the gun violence is, right? The gun violence happens in Chicago, Baltimore, all these cities, New York City, right? These are the cities that have the strictest gun control in the world. And yet they're the most violent, gun violent towns in the world. Like Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Baltimore, they have higher homicide rates than Baghdad and, you know, Bogota, Colombia, right? It has nothing to do with guns. It's a polluted culture is what it is.
And yet the mayor of Chicago specifically goes to the microphones to condemn the president of the United States for his offer to send the National Guard to the city of Chicago to stem the tide of rampant random violence in the streets, as if it's not a problem, as if it's maybe should just be considered a part of normal everyday life. And yet when you contrast Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, St. Louis, on and on and on, to the current state of affairs in Washington, D.C., with going on 2 weeks, I think, without a homicide, where right. You have
the liberals are up in arms and protest. We want our homicides back.
Yeah,
and our rapes.
Yeah.
Where are our rapes?
Make homicide great again. Yeah.
Right.
Where carjackings are down. I'm not making this up. Over 80%. Where violent crime is down over 20%. Where robberies are down 46-47%. These are real numbers affecting real people. And you've got members of the media, as much as they hate the right and hate the Trump administration, actually saying, you know what? I forgot. I almost got knocked upside the head a couple of years ago by this thug.
Right.
And
right.
I'm sure glad I can walk to my car now without worrying about that happening again.
Right. What do you know? If you punish the lawbreakers, they change their behavior. But look, and it's not just guns, right? So let's take this Klobuchar crazed person. So let's talk about knife violence. Let's look at Chicago. You know, Charlotte, our own little Chicago.
Yes.
We'll call it Chicago, right?
Yeah.
Just this week, right? A 23-year-old Ukrainian woman who fled the war in Ukraine was riding the light rail in Chicago, which, by the way, they want to take to Mooresville, and we need to stop
in
that.
In Charlotte.
Yes, yeah. Chicago. And a crazed repeat offender stabbed her to death. And by the way, this isn't, you don't see this in the headlines. He stabbed like six people. Five people, actually. Four went to the hospital and she was killed. So four people stabbed, killed her, the other ones in the hospital. Maybe it was five. But there was no gun. There was a knife. So, okay, what are you going to do about that? And then you want to talk about knife violence. Look no further than across the pond in England. They gathered up all the guns. Can't have a gun. And by the way, when citizens could have guns, the police didn't have guns, right? Then in England, they gathered up all the guns, and then all of a sudden, violence started coming out, and people started getting knifed and clubbed and broken. So now the police, the bobbies, are armed. Isn't that odd?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
The police didn't need to be armed when citizens could own guns. Then as soon as they took all the guns from citizens, they gave guns to police. But anyway, in England, like, stabbings went up and rapes have exploded, right? Mm-hmm. Rapes in England and Scotland are off the chart, like up like 10,000%. And then there's that video of that 14-year-old girl, a Scottish girl, you know, Braveheart, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Where, like, there was this immigrant, right, from, you know, certain countries.
Sudan.
Who was sexually harassing. There were two girls, and this guy was trying to assault one of the girls, and this 14-year-old girl's in very Braveheart fashion. She pulled out a hatchet and a knife to fight off this guy who was probably going to rape this other girl. And guess who they arrested?
Yeah.
The 14-year-old girl brandishing an axe to protect her friend from getting raped.
Right. And so she's a problem child, and yet climate activists like Greta Von Thunberg are, you know, celebrated as, the second coming of God knows who.
I mean,
it's upside down.
It's absolutely insane. It's crazy.
And by the way,
that's all the result of decades and decades, generations of liberal policies.
You're right. And, you know, I hate it when your by the ways are better than mine.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to need some therapy, I think.
I know, I'm sorry.
My by the way didn't okay. cut mustard with your by the
no,
way.
No, go ahead. Let's
so
hear your
by
the
way.
I'm sorry. I did. I did. I cut
but
in your by the
in
way.
In the days prior to the tragic shooting in Minneapolis, none other than the Democrat National Committee was meeting in Minneapolis, ground zero for crazies.
Mm-hmm.
And among the things they were talking about very publicly were, we are sick and tired of those Republicans, and we are going to start taking the fight to them. We're tired of them. We are done staying on the sidelines. We're no longer going to bring our knives to the gunfights. We are going to get tough with these people. We're going to punch them right in the nose. And so they're using all of this
violent,
you know, very sort of a cliche, nonetheless serious talk about taking the fight to the Republicans, to the streets. And then what do they expect? The outcome to be? Right. Are they surprised when the trans crazed kid
that's what they want
shows up on a one fine morning in front of a Catholic mass?
It's their rhetoric. They want their rhetoric to start that, and then so they do this violent rhetoric, and then there's crazy people who actually listen to them who then commit gun violence, and then they can say, "Oh, we want gun control." That's exactly. There's no downside to their violent rhetoric has no downside except. Normal, reasonable people have woken up, and they're not, they're voting against that because normal, reasonable people understand that they're the cause.
Here on the show, we like to say they're not going to take it anymore, is what
right.
we like to say.
Right.
And you know, there are organizations that could really play a positive role in bringing an end to
like our public schools
to this violence our public schools but another
but
one
they
comes
perpetuate
to mind.
It.
Here's one that comes to mind, and we're on the cusp of it. The National Football League, the NFL season will be starting in the next couple of days. Actually, I have to say I'm kind of looking forward to it, but what I'm not looking forward to is the NFL, which could take a role in promoting our law enforcement, our military, the exceptionalism of America. But are you going to see in the back of the end zones stenciled into the rear markings anything along the lines of "Back the Blue"? No, that's not what you're going to see. In fact, for the sixth consecutive season, the NFL is going to subject us to end zone messaging that runs the gamut, and they give the teams the choice. They get a choice to choose between end racism, stop hate, choose love, or inspire change. And then on the other end zone, there will be the oh-so-very-generic reminder that it takes all of us.
So two observations. I'm sorry, we finished?
Well,
by the way,
I would like to remind the commissioner, Roger Goodell, because that's how he thinks of himself, Roger Goodell, that it takes all of us to make the NFL irrelevant, and we could do that very quickly.
Yeah, so why are you going to watch them and support it? I watch college football. Just get your football fix on Saturdays and watch golf on Sunday.
I do draw the curtains. Does that matter?
No, please. Okay. Well, yeah, so no one sees you. We're in shame. But let's talk about the NFL for a minute. Let's look back. You remember all that patriotic stuff? NFL salutes the armed forces. NFL salutes the flag. They were paid to do all that. The DOD was paying the NFL to do salute to America, salute to the troops. The NFL is so fake. They're so anti-American. They do not deserve our viewership.
And I have to say that I really enjoyed it earlier this year when Roger Goodell and some of the other NFL luminaries were forced to stand inside the White House for the announcement that the NFL draft will be coming to Washington. I guess it'll be next year. And Goodell had to stand there in the shadow of the president of the United States. And he looked like a man who was somewhere between a really bad stomach ache and a pending involuntary bowel movement. And it was a joyful thing to watch, I have to say. But okay, I'll try to stick with college football. And
football fix on Saturday. We're boycotting the NFL. Do your part.
All right. Can I at least watch the pregame show, maybe?
Maybe, but don't watch the games. Okay, so one other thing going back to Minnesota is let's not forget the lieutenant governor, Peggy Flanagan, who she's not innocent in all this either. She stood up and gave a speech while wearing a T-shirt that said, "Protect Trans Kids," and it had a K-bar knife on it, right?
Real nice.
Now, it's kind of hard to tell from her picture if she's an OEM female or not. You know, it could go either way. But, you know, so you had Tim Walz turning down money to help protect public schools, private schools.
Failing to pr- pr- promote the legislation that would have provided the funding. Yeah,
making Minnesota trans sanctuary and saying that he's made friends with school shooters. Then you have his lieutenant governor wearing a shirt, protect trans kids, with a picture of a K-bar on it. Then they wonder why this happens. Gosh, I don't know. Maybe cause meet effect, you know?
You're absolutely right. So everybody stick around, because in a few moments we're going to be joined by some very special guests to tell us about the forthcoming Veterans Treatment Court in Moore County.
Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
We're joined now by the special guests I've been telling you about this morning. Our Moore County Clerk of Courts, Todd Maness. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Steve.
And Kristen Gastoni, who is the incoming director of the new Veterans Treatment Court in Moore and Hoke Counties. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
We are so happy that you're both here to tell us about this development, which has been several or more years in the making. The Veterans Treatment Court for Moore and Hoke Counties will be debuting in September, very soon. It will join a number of other similar courts in other counties across the state of North Carolina. So let's start briefly by giving our listeners an overview of what a Veterans Treatment Court does practically on a day-to-day basis for our military veterans.
Veterans Treatment Court is a specialized court. It's a specialized program in our court system geared towards veterans who find themselves in the justice system with service-related PTSD or military sexual trauma, substance abuse issues. And it's kind of an alternative pathway for these guys.
No, they live in the real world. They come back from their deployments. Sometimes things go a little sideways. They find themselves going before a judge in a court, and they need a little extra help, and that's what this system is there to do. Is that right, basically?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, we'll help get them set up with treatment, mentorship.
We can help with a wide range of things, and every plan is tailored to each individual veteran. Because not everybody's suffering from the same things. Not everybody's needs are the same. So as a team, we get together, we go over what's the best plan for the veteran. Maybe they need education, so we help them with that component. Maybe they need mental health or physical health care, substance abuse, you know, helping them get away from the things that they've been using as a crutch.
The goal is to still hold them accountable.
Right, for whatever they may be charged with.
Right, right.
Sure.
But helping them to succeed long term.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is ultimately the goal of the entire court system. But in the case of our veterans, we recognize that they deserve our added assistance as they try to make their way through life after having served their country nobly and honorably for many years. So let's talk about the process that leads us to the debut of this Veterans Treatment Court, which I believe is scheduled for September 25th. And we'll get to that a little later. But how did we get here? What mountains did you have to move to make this a reality?
Well, Steve, whenever I was running for Clerk of Courts, the first time I talked with it about other folks that were like-minded was Jim Von Cannon, who's now our County Commissioner, and Kurt Cook. And both of those gentlemen are veterans, served our country. And we were talking about Veterans Treatment Court then, how, you know, we all three of us would like to see it in Moore County.
And it wasn't an abstract idea, because they existed in, I read where Cumberland County has had one since 2008, which, of course, is the home county of Fort Bragg.
So yes, continue. Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
And I believe Buffalo, New York was where the first Veterans Treatment Court came out of, and it spread across the whole country. So fast forward, I got elected to be clerk. Love it, by the way. And matter of fact, me and Kristen had talked about Veterans Treatment Court, but you know, I was working on getting the office set up and rebuilt. And our Chief Justice, Paul Newby, while I was at Raleigh, he asked me if I would help spearhead getting a Veterans Treatment Court in Moore County because he saw the need too.
That would be State Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul Newby, yes.
The
good man to have on your team.
A great man to have on our team, and he was very helpful through the entire process. Anytime I ever needed anything, I could pick up the phone and call him, and he would pick up the phone, call me, and check on the status of it. So it was something that was important to him. But whenever I got back from that, I reached out to our senior resident Superior Court Judge, Michael Stone, and he was all in as well. And then our district attorney, Mike Harden, and he was all in. And we've had a whole bunch of characters that all needed to be involved. We had to write a grant. Ms. Gastoni is an excellent writer, and I asked her if she would write the grant. And she said it would be an honor, and she started working on the grant. And grants are hard. Grants are extremely hard. We competed against 47 other states, counties, and even Native American tribes in the United States, and we got the grant. It's $900,000 to get us started, and that's for 4 years.
That's a significant amount of money that you're asking for.
A huge amount of money.
And received.
Yes, sir. It's a huge amount of money, but we had to ask the county, basically, if they would submit the grant for us. We would write the grant. They would submit the grant, and our county commissioners, we have extremely good county commissioners.
We do.
It was a unanimous vote. They were all in favor of it. Jim Von Cannon and Kurt Cook, they're on the Veterans Affairs Board, and they've really grown like the Veteran Services in Moore County with Kelly Green, and they've done a great job. But we had to ask them to run the grant through them, and they did. We applied for the grant. Kristen wrote it, and she did an excellent job, especially competing against she did. And we got awarded the grant.
Is this federal funds that you're...
It is.
That you apply for?
Bureau of Justice.
The Bureau of Justice Assistance. It's a department of the Department of Justice.
So now here we are. The grant has been awarded, and you're off to the races. Kristen comes along to become your director. And so what happens now? Let's say we get into October, November of this year. The Veterans Treatment Court is up and running. It's going to be run out of the Moore County Courthouse, I presume?
Correct.
It will be, sir.
And what are the challenges, the responsibilities, the goals and objectives day-to-day of your court in terms of moving forward, making a difference?
So when we identify a veteran who has been arrested, who ends up in the court system, we approach them with, it's a voluntary program. We approach them and describe the program to them, and it's really tough. It's 18 months at a minimum that they go through this program. And a lot of times a veteran might find, you know, I can do a month in jail and that's easier. I'll just do that. So it really is going to be work to get them on board.
So you're saying you almost have to do some recruiting. You have to sell this to the veteran community.
Whenever they're coming into contact with law enforcement, they've been charged with something. We can find out that they're a veteran through the magistrate's office, where they come through and they basically fill out a form, or the jail through the sheriff's office, or the district attorney's office, working with the attorneys throughout the county. We tried to reach out to the attorneys and let everybody know this is here now. So there's many ways of identifying them, and then we have to talk with them and basically let them know this is not easy. But if you want help, if you truly want help, we can help get you to where you want to be. You know, we don't do it for them, and we hold them accountable. But ultimately, if they truly want to break the cycle and get what they need to be successful, we can help them with that.
And, of course, we know that statistically, the suicide rate among veterans is astronomically high, and I suspect that part of that is attributed to sort of going down that path of destructive behavior, and once it starts, it kind of snowballs, and then you get in trouble with the law, and then you're in the court system, and then you feel like you're sort of overwhelmed, and next thing you know, the walls come kind of tumbling down. So you're there as a defense mechanism. And what are the stories that you have heard about from these other veteran treatment courts? In other words, in reading about this a little bit before our conversation, in Cumberland County alone, that director, who is a former member of the 82nd Airborne, I believe, in Cumberland, says they've helped at least 150 veterans. That they, you know, it may be more than that by now. But what inspired you? Will inspire you going forward? I mean, what can the outcomes be? What are the stories like on the other end?
We have traveled to several different veterans treatment courts here in North Carolina. We've been to different graduations and we've seen day-to-day affairs of how things are basically set up and run. These men and women that are in those programs that we've seen, very much, they were kind of at their end. The guys that had basically been separated from their families, their wives, their kids, not being able to hold a job, not being able to basically do the things that you need to be able to do to be successful in life. And to see, you know, people that are have been broken and get the help that they need and rebound, being able to basically become part of their family again and be what they were to their family again, being able to get a job and get a better job than what they'd had before sometimes, being able to get the education that they need to be successful. It literally is life-changing, and to tell you the truth, saves lives.
But that's the challenge. Taking someone who is hopeless and convincing them that there is hope. Mm-hmm. That's what the challenge is.
And you can empathize with that, Kristen, because you have lived in that parallel universe of overseas deployment as a security contractor. You understand uniquely what that separation from what we call the real world, I guess, is like, and how difficult it can be to re-enter that when you come home. Mm-hmm. Do we underestimate how hard that is? I mean, people like me walking around living our lives, do we have any conceptualization of how hard that is?
Unless you've been there, unless you've lived that, had those experiences, it's hard to empathize. It is. And from my own personal experience, just having somebody to talk to once I came home, that's where my challenges started. I am currently in my own treatment, but it took a while to get there. Mm-hmm. It took a while for me to identify that I needed help. Mm-hmm. So we'll approach these veterans with the same thing. They don't all know why, whether it's PTSD, or traumatic brain injury. You don't always know you have that. So part of the treatment is identifying the actual problems that they have.
And of course, the court system is, you know, I think you can tell me if I'm wrong, but there are judges out there who are themselves military veterans. Mm-hmm. I know some of them. And so they have that understanding. And this will just, you know, to the extent that they want to do what they can within the boundaries of the law to be empathetic toward a veteran, now you're providing this other layer of assistance to help them do that as judges, too.
Mm-hmm. It's a different avenue to be able to help these men and women that need help. And we live free, you know, here in our country, and whenever we go to bed at night, we're safe because these people have served us. And it's also for active duty as well. It's not just veterans. It's active duty as well that are still serving us, protecting us.
Now, as you get closer to the debut of this court, what will be the best way for a veteran or the spouse of a veteran or a friend of a veteran who wants to help to get in touch with the court? Is there a website? What's the best way to do that going forward?
There is not a website yet. We'll be working on that, and Facebook page. But they can always reach out to me, and I can give my phone number.
Through the Moore County Courthouse, too, I suppose, right? Just
yeah, you can call the Moore County Courthouse at 910-722-5000. Or you can call me directly, 910-947-4029.
910-947-4029.
Correct.
That's direct access to Kristen.
Yep.
That's very good. Thank you for sharing that. Now, lest we forget, coming up on September 25th, you're going to kick off the Veterans Treatment Court with a special event. Tell us about that.
Like I was telling you earlier, we had a lot of hands that were involved in this. This was truly a group effort, and no one single person could have done this. I helped kind of spearhead things. If it hadn't been for Kristen writing the grant, we wouldn't have been off the ground. The county commissioners, if they hadn't submitted it for us. We had Richard Hudson, Congressman Hudson, who actually helped write a letter for the grant. Congressman Bishop, Dan Bishop, whenever he was a congressman, he wrote a letter as well. Mm-hmm. Our Chief Justice helping push this through. The board that Judge Stone formed, and that's Judge Stone, our DA, Mike Harden, Judge Creed. We have a defense attorney, Matthew Rothbein, and myself on the board. So it took a whole lot of hands putting this together. So it's going to be basically a grand opening for it and a ribbon cutting. And to tell you the truth, a celebration, because this is going to be something that will change lives in Moore County. And it doesn't just help the veteran. It doesn't just help their family. It helps their friends. It helps their community. It helps everyone.
Mm-hmm. And it helps our community safer. And we hope that everyone comes out and celebrates with us.
Thursday, September 25th.
At 10 a.m.
10 a.m. at the
Moore County Courthouse.
The actual courthouse.
Yep.
Any specific location that you know of?
Second floor.
Okay.
Superior Courtroom. Guest that will be at the event, special guest, will be Congressman Hudson will be there. Our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Paul Newby, will be there. Phil Berger, Jr., also a Supreme Court Justice. Our Director of the Administrative Office of the Court, Ryan
Boyce.
Ryan Boyce. And many other county officials. And it's going to be a celebration. So we would like everyone to come that would like to be there.
Cool. Let's honor their sacrifice.
Well, we will put that on the calendar, and we thank you both for joining us today on Taking Aim, and we will stay in touch with you going forward on this incredible project, and thank you again for being a part of it and coming in today and joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You bet.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We thank all of you for joining us. This and every Saturday here on Taking Aim, your favorite Saturday morning show exclusively on WEEB. We never run out of targets. We enjoy covering all the bases with you, and we will see you again right here next time. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.